the Broadcasting Network. Listen, learn, be bold.
Hey, hello, I'm like in your brain, or in via your ears. This is just a note to say that the podcast you're about to listen to is brought to you by the dudes at Motorola. Okay, enjoy, dude.
Doc Searles.
Doc Searles, this is Cameron Riley.
Hold on a second. Plain old telephone service coming through, huh?
Yeah, I couldn't see you on Skype, so I thought I'd call you here first and see if you want to.
Well,
I'm
busy loading Skype onto this thing. Hang on a second. Let me see if I can get it in here and see what happens with it. Hate to have you guys paying the bill as big as this is likely to be for a long conversation if it goes long.
It's 60 cents, Doc.
60 cents.
Cents.
Oh, right, because you're using Skype out, right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, shit.
Yeah, shit. I can afford 60 cents, Doc. I'm broke, but I'm not that broke.
Oh, shit, okay. Well, hang on a second, because this being telephony and all, like, it could be I could actually patch through the decent microphone into this thing. So let me see what happened. Let me just see if Skype comes up now. I had to replace the app because I'm using an old machine.
What are you using an old machine for? A man like
yourself
should be using an old machine.
The less old machine is in the shop. I put it in the wrong place, and my kid kicked it off the table, and a bunch of shit happened.
Oh, no.
And there it is. Okay. Well, the promo on here says the whole world can talk for free. Who knew? let's see. I just heard something about 60 cents. So, let's see. I'm agreeing to a license agreement. Okay. Which nobody ever reads, not even lawyers.
Oh, I know lots of Microsoft lawyers who spend their lives reading the EULA, mate.
Oh, really? You know, there's when I used to produce long documents when I was in marketing, I would actually put stuff in the middle of it saying, if you're actually reading this, please send a note to this address just to let me know it's actually getting read. And I was never heard anything, right? I knew it wasn't getting read.
Easter eggs in
right,
the
exactly.
EULA.
They were like Easter eggs, yeah. They were for my amusement alone. It's like I worked in radio once in North Carolina about 10,000 years ago, and I used to do a Sunday morning. I used to be in charge of Sunday mornings, which is you put on tapes of church broadcasts and things. There used to be this public service requirement in the U.S. that forced radio stations to cram all the stuff they didn't want to play into Sunday mornings. And in the Bible Belt, it was a pretty good chance nobody was listening anyway. So, after a while, I realized nobody's listening, right? So I remember once there was a guy named Oral Roberts, and I renamed him Anal Roberts and just had fun with it. And one time, one person called me, and it turned out she was one of the salespeople for the station, and she was listening halfway across the state wondering what the hell I was up to. I said, you're the listener. It's your job. It's like a phone call. I get a 5,000-watt phone call here. It's three towers out in a swamp talking to you.
That sounds like my podcast. I just always assume that no one's listening and I can just say whatever the hell I want.
Yeah. Well, it says here, okay, my Skype is up now. Can you guys see me?
There's just me for a start, mate. Mick's not about. He doesn't do many podcasts these days. I can't see you, but I'm going to try and call you anyway. So let's see if something pops up. I'm going to say hi. Can you see that?
I don't, you know, now that I think about it, I don't think I can get a, I don't think I can patch my good podcasting microphone that I never use because I never do podcasts into this thing.
Well, I can hear you fine. I think we can
just
go with
this. Yeah, you can hear me fine. Okay, we'll let it go with that. So what's up, guys?
Doc Searles,
you're
scaring the pants off us, man.
You have to read the whole thing. That way your pants will stay on.
I read the whole thing, and I had to have a nap in the middle of it because it's very long.
It's very long.
But it's definitely worth reading. But it's seriously, man, this is one of the scariest things I read. So the backstory for this is I had your erstwhile colleague, Mr. Weinberger, on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was sounding fairly fairly skeptical about the future of the net. And I was like, get out of town. And he said, no, no, doctors put up this thing today. Go read it. And so I went and read it, and I went, holy shit.
Yeah, you saw what David said, which is, you know, there's another choice, which is to join me in my trough of despair.
Now, I do note that in, you know, since you put that out, people like Chris Nolan have come out and tried to dampen down the fear and misgivings a bit. But for the listeners, I've been urging them over the last couple of weeks to go and have a read of your article on Linux Journal. But just for those that either haven't been bothered or couldn't read anything that long because they're so used to reading.
For our listeners out there that are not readers.
Yeah, that's right. They're used to reading text messages. I've sort of tried to communicate it, but it's going to come best from yourself. So give us the high-level situation here, Doc. What is going on in your country?
Well, there's a good percentage of the pipes, as it were, that the Internet runs on are owned by the telephone and cable companies, and it used to be in the past that there were long distance companies that had no local presence, like MCI, for example. MCI owned an awful lot of the backbone of the net here in the U.S. and probably elsewhere, for all I know. But there were essentially companies that were not involved in the local telephone service that laid out a lot of this cabling out there. And now what's happening is that the short story is that as the old telco business and the cable business consolidate, those guys find themselves in control of not just what we call the last mile or the last 100 feet or the last whatever it is to homes and businesses, but also the backbone. And they are starting to make noises that suggest that they want to start discriminating based on traffic, so they can extract more money out of the system. In other words, they don't see the net as essentially a neutral. That's the term that's coming into use now is neutrality. That there's this term net neutrality, which means essentially that the net is a fundamental utility that is akin to the water service or the electric service, or those are probably the two best comparisons. I wouldn't say the phone service, because phone service is a bit more complex, but but essentially is just a plain utility that is provided, I hesitate to use the term delivered for reasons I'll go into in a minute, to homes and businesses for the purpose of whatever it is that the net does, but you essentially don't care about what's in the packets. Much as, for example, the railroad systems in most countries don't really care what's in the container cargo that travels on it. Or, for that matter, the same is true with container ships. The whole point of the container cargo business is that you have a little clipboard or something on the outside or in the ship's manifest referring to the container cargo, saying, you might say this is said to contain something or other, but for the most part they don't care, you know, unless they're transporting nuclear waste or you know, something that is unusually volatile or where the weight shifts or it really ought to cost more or some other thing like that. You don't care what's on it. And the way that the net was set up, it's irrelevant. It's all converted into packets, and it's all flows around. And those guys shouldn't have to care about it, but they do want to start caring about it because they want to extract more revenue from it. Well, this breaks the net as we understand it. We've always understood the net, those of us who have been involved in it, and in its virtues and in its growth as a service, as a I mean, say, for example, the people that have been working on RSS and tagging and XML and all the rest of it. These are all ways that the net gets improved that never show up in the pipes themselves. There's one character in particular, a guy named, it's either Whiteacre or Whitaker, who runs SBC, which used to stand for Southwestern Bell. It's one of the shards of the old Ma Bell, which was AT&T, that was broken up by the government in 1984, into 8 regional Bell companies, and so they've been buying each other up, and other phone services as well. And SBC is emerging as the along with Verizon, which is the other big one. They're now just basically those two. Those are the two big telephone companies, and both of them. And I don't want to be totally unfair here, but they're freaking evil companies. I mean, it's just no doubt about it. In some ways, they really want to break the net as we understand it. I think that's less true of Verizon, but Verizon is just basically a big company that gives bad service. Neither one of them have any imagination about what they could do. For example, they could provide symmetrical service to the home, and that's unencumbered. And for maybe a little bit more, they don't block port 80 and they don't block port 25. And homes could set up their own businesses and put servers in their homes. And the phone companies, for that matter, could offer, say, hosting, which they've never really bothered to do in a serious way. But they can only imagine an asymmetrical service like you get with cable television. It's the few-to-many, top-down pyramid model of the world, and that's the model that they still have, and there's no hope that these guys are ever going to change their minds. They've been working on lobbying Congress for a very long time for what amounts to a kind of favoritism in the regulatory framework. So are we still on the air here?
Yeah, I'm still listening, man.
Making sure. So that's the dark scenario. Is that the people that control the pipes, at least in the U.S., and there's no, there's plenty to give us despair happening outside the country as well. We can go into that outside this country anyway. We can go into that if we want to. But there are other. The short of it is that there are other countries out there that envy China.
There are countries other than the United States.
And that's a tough one. I mean, I had a good friend down here who's passing through. He's not a net savvy guy. And he asked me what I'd been writing, and I told him about it, and I told him how, other countries, envy China, and they want to be able to filter their packets and essentially set up customs blockades and all the rest of it. And his response was, well, why shouldn't they? They protect their airspace, you can't fly over China if they don't want you to, and why can't they? It's a perfectly legitimate thing. And I thought, oh my God, this is a hard one to describe to people who don't understand that the net is fundamentally not a national thing. It is, it is non-national, as I put it in the article, the unseen bulk of the earth, that gives us gravity and nobody owns. I think you call it the ownerless bulk of the earth. That what holds us on the surface of the earth is a whole bunch of stuff that it's pointless to even think that anybody owns.
Okay, but the laissez-faire capitalist in me comes out and says, well, these guys did spend tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in aggregate over the last 10 years rolling out these pipes. Surely they have some claim to making a return on that investment.
Okay, so sure, make a return on your investment. Just don't do it in a way that breaks the net. There are lots of ways they can make a return on that investment. Lots and lots of ways. They're making a return right now. Try and buy an OC3 from SBC. They're going to charge you a good price for it. I mean, it's not like they're not making money on this stuff. It's not like it's not being leveraged. It's not like they can't make money the way they're already making money with it. It's not like they can't make money more ways than they do already without screwing up what is the essentially open nature of the net. So anyway, that's the downside. That's the despairing side. There is an upside too. So just to give you the outline of the whole story. The upside is they don't own the whole thing, right? There are lots and lots of other players besides those guys in the business, not the least of which is Google. Google is going out of its way in this country right now to buy up a lot of what's called dark fiber. There's an awful lot of dark fiber that's laying in the ground. It's owned by cities. It's owned by utility companies. If you're an electric company, a lot of the electric companies have long since put fiber on electric poles, because it is completely immune from RF and EMF and other forms of interference, but a lot of that has never been fully utilized, and so Google is running around and very quietly buying that stuff up. And Google is, in spite of, you know, some concerns that people have that they are kind of a monoculture and they're becoming more of a monopoly in a number of ways, Vint Cerf, who's considered one of the net's main fathers, works there. They are a net native company. They grew up out of the net. They're not like the phone companies that predate the net and never understood the net. They totally are immersed in it and are in a good position to understand it and are very much dead set against what those utilities want to do. And then there are, for example, in the university system here in California, the backbone there is something called CENIC, C-E-N-I-C. It's completely independent of all the carriers. They can thrive independently of that. They can, you know, they can work out deals. There are plenty of ways to bypass whatever chokeholds that the carriers might put in the system. That's the optimist. The optimistic view says, you know what, for whatever reasons, the marketplace is bigger than those guys alone. They can screw it up if they want, but they're not the whole deal, and there are other guys that are good that can fight them on that. And that's basically the bypass case. And there are a number of different ways of looking at that. Now, there are some, I believe David Weinberger is one of them, although I haven't really checked with him on this, but my guess, knowing his political leanings, he would lean toward a legislative solution to this that would enforce network neutrality. There are many people in technology who are inherently libertarian. I tend to lean that way, though I'm kind of what I call a lily-livered libertarian, which is somebody who is sort of a libertarian with a heart. I think there are some ways that, I think there's some reasons to get government involved in things. But on the whole, most, like a lot of people who are coming from technology, I believe that most legislation that the feds could come up with will have more bad unintended consequences than good ones, than good intended consequences. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we came up with a law insisting on net neutrality that there wouldn't be some unseen way that would screw something else up. And not just in the U.S., I mean, in around the world, who knows.
Can you go backwards for a minute and explain to me what is the opposite of net neutrality? Are they suggesting that there's going to be tiered pricing depending on what kind of content you're trying to send over their
pipes? That one possibility. There's essentially it's packet discrimination. Now of course there'll be people who tell you, you know what, there's packet discrimination going on already anyway. There's a lot of looking at what's going on down in there, and things get rerouted anyway. But it's not strictly in respect to the content, and it's not prejudicial in the way that these guys would like it to be. So right now, as I put it in the piece that I wrote, there's a natural kind of weird alliance possible between the content providers, and essentially between the primary or major providers of packet freight in the form of the entertainment business, and the publishing business on the one hand, and the carriers on the other. So now some of the content guys, the record industry and the movie industry in particular, that want to have digital rights management maintained or inserted or otherwise enforced at every level in every place they possibly can. They want your PC to be crippled so it only plays what they want you to play. They want your software crippled so it'll do that. They want the whole freaking system crippled in their favor. They feel like they've been screwed over by the net. The net's a genie that got out of the bottle. And so, of course, that to the carriers looks like, oh, they're customers. They're a big provider of content. We can help them out. We can deal, right? So, okay, entertainment industry, you want that? Well, let's talk. Let's talk turkey, and we'll get together on this thing, and we'll make this work. And, of course, the Ciscos of the world, which are busy putting up the the Great Chinese Firewall right now are, from all we can tell, perfectly willing at some point. Maybe somebody from Cisco will listen to this and say, no, you're full of shit, that's not going to happen. But we have the Great Chinese Firewall going up, so we know that can happen. But they, you know, there's a business for them in inserting the DRM down in the system so that when I want to, you know, I want to download, I mean, let's say that I've got a movie that I that's on my server and I'm somewhere else. I want to put it on my laptop and watch it there. It's my movie. Doesn't matter. They're going to stop it because that's not an authorized activity. That's not an authorized use of the movie. There's DRM in the system. They're going to cut it off at the pass. So, you know, I mean, I don't know what Chris Nolan's position on this is. I know she believes that I'm, that my piece was naive in the sense that there is going to be legislation. The bad guys are going to win some fights here. And what we really need to do is play political hardball, with other parties. And I think we do have to do that also. I'm not sure I agree with her, though, on some of those issues. But she and I need to talk more about it. We sort of agreed to talk without you know, going any further with it.
So this idea of tiered pricing, isn't that kind of like telcos saying, well, yeah, we'll install a phone line into your house and charge you a fee for that and a monthly rental of that phone line. But if you do any business deals over that phone line, we want to take a cut.
Well, it's not so much you want to take a cut. We just want to charge you more for it. We'll charge you more for a business line than we'll charge you for a home line. I've got that right now with my internet service. If I don't want port 80 blocked and I don't want port 25 blocked, I'm going to pay for that. If I want an IP address, I'm going to pay for that. It's really lame the way it's set up. I mean, it's, and I actually don't have a problem with that because at least I have a somewhat of a problem, but it's not. The problem I have with it right now is just that they're being stupid and I'm just simply dumb and not opportunistic. I mean, I think they could provide lots of services to businesses that they're not providing right now because business is such a small part of what they do. And this is more true of the cable companies than it is of the phone companies. Phone companies do have a lot more business relationships, but with Verizon, which is the only phone company here, right now, I can't even get them on the phone. I want to get their DSL here. I can't get it. This is too hard to get them on the phone. But with Cox, which is our cable company here, I'm paying. Well, when I moved here, I got 7 megabytes down and I got 3 megabytes up, which was like nearly Korean rates. It was terrific. And then their backbone provider went out of business and they throttled it back to 3 megabytes down and 300 kilobytes up, and they blocked port 25 and they blocked port 80. And they raised the prices. Now they've raised the prices again. They're trying to bundle cable TV service with it, and the service has gotten worse, and it's because a lot of downtime. The service has gone nowhere but to hell because what they're doing is, I'm told, biasing the service in favor of cable TV. And their public relations manager, their public, I guess, I don't know what he's called, public something manager, told me the other day that that they really see no demand for better service to the home, better internet service to the home. But there's no way they could notice it. They don't offer it, so how could they tell?
That reminds me of Telstra, Australia's former monopoly telco in this country. From about 1997 when they rolled out cable around the country but didn't do the last mile, except for a small number of homes. And they were trying to charge like $1,000 a month for cable to the home. Mm. And they were doing this for 5, 6, 7 years. And every time they'd get criticized for the fact that, you know, their cable pricing was so high, their comeback in the press was, well, people don't want broadband in this country. Look, no one's taking it up. If they wanted to take it up, we'd sell more of it and be able to drop the price.
Exactly. It's incredibly dumb how they do it.
But that wasn't dumb at all. That was smart. I was closely involved.
I guess
involved.
I missed that part.
Well, I was you know, closely involved with their senior execs for a part of that period, and I had several of them tell me they didn't want broadband to be rolled out because they had no idea what impact it was going to have on their business. So
they rolled out cable around the country to stop the competition from getting a foothold, who were also rolling out cable. Telstra had deeper pockets from their, you know, sort of many, many, the decades they had a monopoly on the local loop. But it was smart. They didn't want broadband. And you made the point in your article that the one thing that the telcos, the content companies, and the government all have in common is they all hate the net.
Yep, they do.
Because, as you say, and I've seen this with telcos in Australia, and I'm sure it's true over there, they spent the 90s and the first, 5 years of this decade investing in this stuff, but thinking that eventually they'd figure out how to control it. And I think they're finally coming to the realization that not only, A, can they not control what goes on, but B, services are evolving on top of this infrastructure that are white-anting their business model faster than they can go boo, right? So it makes a lot of sense. You know, the capitalist in me says it makes a lot of sense. Well, if something that you own is starting to put you out of business, what do? You react against it and try and shut it the hell down.
Right. So if it's conceivable, for example, that if Verizon gets the legislative leeway that it wants, and if they see, for example, that in Santa Barbara where I live, I don't really have much in the way of alternatives, which I suppose I do, but what I'm going toward with this is they could shut off exactly what we've got right now. They could say, oh, Skype packet's on the line, kill it, right, and force you and I to find some other way to have a conversation using packets. That's conceivable. It's entirely conceivable. I'm not sure they would do that. I'm not sure they have it together enough to do that, or would have it together enough to do that. But I know that that's the direction they would like to go.
Well, hasn't Whitaker...
All indications that that's what they'd like to do.
Hasn't the CEO of SBC, or I think they've changed their name back to AT&T now, haven't they?
Yeah, they are turning into AT&T, that's what I'm told. You know, I keep looking for examples of how that's going to happen.
Hasn't he already said that he's going to roll out Verso's Skype-blocking routers on his network?
I don't know.
I read an interview with him where he said that's going to happen.
Yeah, the tough thing is that there's so much going on all at once, and you can attack this issue from so many angles. For example, among the people I heard back from was one guy who said, look, a politician is nothing more than a way to pool interests. So right now, the cable companies and the entertainment companies own quite a few legislators. But there are other lobbying groups, like, for example, the AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons. This is in the U.S. And for that matter, even, weird ones like the churches and the National Rifle Society Association and others that you might not imagine would be on the same side of an issue, but they might be on the right side of this particular issue. And they already have strong lobbying organizations in place, and it might be worth trying to go at some of those guys. That's one way one could go at it.
But who's going to go at it? Who's going to lead that? The EFF?
Well, I honestly think there's going to be two different ways of going at it. I mean, I think the EFF is doing everything it can. The problem is that the EFF and Creative Commons and a few other organizations like that are kind of have their hands full doing whatever their particular issue is. I think that the groups that are not fully together right now include, basically there are two. There's sort of three. One is kind of on the corporate side. I think there are companies other than Google that need to get into the game. Whether it's Yahoo or Microsoft or Intel or Apple looking overseas, the cellular companies, the cellular carriers, the cellular equipment providers. I mean, there are a lot of other companies that have an interest at some level in preserving the net neutrality and could do something like what Google's doing now. That's one possibility. Another one is this is a coalition of already powerful lobbying organizations that have to do with providing one kind of a service or another. I mean, it might be retirees and God knows who else, but that's another possibility is those guys. And a third is individuals. I think that they're, that right now we need, I mean, about 4 years ago, I called for a million geek march on Washington.
Get out of here.
I was
just going to tell you, I wrote a blog post like 2 days ago saying, you know what, we need a million geek march, and it should be headed up by Doc Searls. He's our Martin Luther King.
Well, this is an example of what a bad leader I am. on the Linux show, which is then on the radio, on the web radio, this is before podcasting, it was a streamed show, and I wish it would come back. It was really good. And it was run by a guy named Jeff Gearhart out of Chicago. And I don't remember what the issue was at that time. I think it was whatever Larry Lessig was talking about then, and he was challenging geeks to get together and do this. And I called for a million geek march in Washington, and Jeff went and actually legally set up a political action committee called Geek PAC, and a nonprofit organization called the American Open Technology Consortium, AOTC, and he incorporated them. And he did a whole bunch of other stuff, and he made me president of them, and I agreed to it, and I dropped the ball. I just couldn't do that and keep my job at the same time because it was just too much. It's not me, right? Years ago when I ran a company, there was a kind of not so much a mutiny, but there was we had some issues inside the company, and then my employees told me, they said, you know what, you're a really good leader and a really lousy manager. And that's really true. I'm not a good manager.
The two are rarely combined.
Myself. What's that?
The two are rarely combined into a single individual.
You want me to stand in front of a parade? I'll be glad to stand in front of a parade. But somebody else has to organize the parade.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at that. And I do think we need a million geek march, but I think we need to be pretty clear. And this would be Chris Nolan talking. You know, I mean, I think Chris would say, you know, you march a million geeks on Washington, and you're going to lose more votes than you'll get. And that's maybe true. I don't know, but I think we need to make clear that the net is something that belongs to, you know, belongs to everybody or essentially belongs to nobody. It's not, and we need to keep it like that. It's like the stars and like the atmosphere and like gravity, and we need to keep it clear. And we don't need laws governing it. It's ludicrous to try and do that. And it's going to be interesting to see. I don't know this. I mean, you know, all the blow-ups around ICANN and around whatever it was that happened in Tunisia that I didn't pay close enough attention to, but essentially involves other countries doing their part and organizations in those countries doing their part to govern the net. In some cases, this is the case with ICANN, ICANN only really governs the names. I mean, it's only what happens in DNS, essentially. Yet, a lot of people are characterizing that as controlling the net. It's really not controlling the net. It's just, you know, the naming system for the net, and it is screwed up. But I'm not sure it's the U.S. or anything particularly U.S.-ish about it, other than stupid deals between ICANN and VeriSign and stuff like that. So. Anyway, so it's huge. It's a huge topic. My own angle on it, and this is the last part of the article, is that I think that we are going to lose if we characterize the net only and fundamentally as a set of pipes, because that characterization alone can give rise to legislation and regulation that does favor the carriers. And the carriers love to characterize it as pipes because that's what they own. Yet our perception of the net is very different than that. When we go on the net, we don't think we're going on pipes. I mean, you and I have a sense that we're in the same place right now, that we're in the same space. I mean, the fact that we're talking to each other from opposite sides of the world is irrelevant, because essentially we're zero distance from each other. I mean, we're one unit of latency, whatever that is, away from each other, and it really doesn't affect the conversation. So essentially we're zero distance. That's the way the net works. The net has characteristics that cannot be defined by pipes any more than you could describe any physical object from a rock to a computer in terms of physics and chemistry. It can't be done.
Yeah, now that this part of your article I agree with, because terminology is, you know, has always been one of the most carefully honed tools of propaganda and you know, mm-hmm. wins the hearts and minds of people if well executed. And I think I understand what you mean, because I don't really think of the internet as being pipes. I think of it as being a space, a place. I guess I've read too many William Gibson novels mm-hmm. in my time, and it is the world that I live in, and all of my, well, not all, but a lot of my relationships and friendships and business collaborations reside in. But I don't know that I've come up with or found a very clear way to articulate that. Where does it reside if it's not on the pipes and in the server rooms? I mean,
it doesn't. That's the whole thing, is it doesn't live anywhere any more than thought lives somewhere. We think it's in our heads, but is it really? I mean, a lot of what you think and what I think is going to live on in the world after we're gone, and it lives on in other people. I mean, there's just so many ways that the net and what happens on it is not understandable in terms of a plumbing system. The interesting thing here, and this goes a bit deeper, is that a lot of people think, well, what I'm talking about here is language. It's really not language. It's concepts, because concepts would give rise to language. So, for example, it's very hard to understand what life itself is. You know, what is life? I mean, we all have it. We all know, you know, in our bodies what it means, what it is to be alive, and yet when it comes to describing it, very few of us would call it, say, you know, a stable, open biological, you know, a self-sustaining, open biological system, right? That doesn't make any sense. Yet, if you look at the way we conceive life, we, from the vocabulary those concepts yield, we find that we think of life mostly in terms of travel. We say birth is arrival and death is departure and choice is a crossroads and careers are paths and we get stuck in a rut and fall off a wagon and move into the passing lane and a decision we'll call a fork in the road. I mean, it's endless the degree to which we conceive of life as travel. And that, by the way, gives rise to the whole class of metaphors that fall into the category of conduits, and business is one of them. And content or goods that we load into a channel for delivery to end users or consumers. And I mean, business itself, we talk about the value chain. We conceive of what happens in business as a value chain, you know, that moves along. That's a conduit metaphor. That's a transport metaphor. And we can't get away from transport metaphors, and there's nothing wrong with them. The problem is that they're inadequate. And that's why I think it's important to go back and look at how the net was understood in the first place by the people who are creating it, and how it's understood by the people who use it in ways that are not reducible to pipes, and are more accurately describe what goes on there. When, you know, like right now when we're talking, I mean, conversation between human beings happens in a location. It has to happen in a location. People need to be able to hear each other. The net is a place where it's possible for people that are widely separated to hear each other and converse with each other. Well, the phone system is too. That's what we talk about, going on the phone and not through the phone. the thing is that it's not in the interest of the phone companies, if they want to maximize their control over the system, to conceive it as this vague thing we call a space. It's much easier to regulate it as a transport system. So the example I give for what's wrong with conceiving something entirely as a transport system is the censorship that we have around broadcasting, that we don't have around the press. In this country, when the country was founded, the First Amendment to the Constitution said Congress shall make no laws restricting freedom of the speech or freedom of press. Well, both of those took place in a space, right? It took place in the public square, in the commons, and in print. And there was no such thing as broadcast in those days. It was actually probably inconceivable. But the fact is that there have been no laws that severely restrict one's ability to publish or to speak in the U.S., and the rest of the world is more or less modeled on the same thoughts that came out of the same philosophical systems that predate the U.S. and every other country that came out of those traditions. So if we conceive of speech as something that's protected, that happens in a place. In the meantime, broadcasting has almost entirely been conceived as a transport system. And in the U.S. at least, with the FCC, which is our the government agency that oversees broadcast, and for that matter telephony, there's this concept that was burned into the 1996, I think it was, Telecom Act, that of an information service. And an information service is one that's conceived as a transport service. And and going back 70 years, it's been possible for the FCC to, on instructions from Congress, they will insist, restrict what could be said on the airwaves. So that's, the way you reconcile the paradox of a regulatory system that outright restricts speech with a constitutional mandate that speech should be free is that you conceive what happens in broadcast as transport and not as speech in a public place. So that's all very complicated, at its base, what it requires is that we as consciously as possible regard the net as a place as well as, and not, and in some cases instead of, a system of pipes. Without denying the obvious fact that it depends on the system of pipes.
I mean, I grasp what you're saying and I agree with you, but I just think that the argument sounds like something that came out of San Francisco, quite frankly, mate. It's
actually Berkeley. What I'm leveraging here is cognitive linguistics, which is a branch of cognitive science, and the main guy behind that is George Lakoff, and he's out of UC Berkeley.
It wasn't Chomsky one of the founders of cognitive linguistics?
Actually, cognitive linguistics kind of branched off of Chomsky in Boston, I guess, at MIT, and Lakoff was a student of Chomsky.
Right. I had Chomsky on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Chomsky's system. The thing is that in the simplest way, I mean, it's important to understand that how we frame things, how we understand things matters.
Yeah.
It matters
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah.
And there are ironies and there are paradoxes involved in that, and we have to admit those are there too.
What I meant more about your analogies, though, is I just, I can imagine somebody like yourself, who is probably as articulate on this subject as any of us are going to be, standing up in front of Congress or in front of the Supreme Court and arguing the case that the internet is a place versus a system of pipes and servers. And it just strikes me as being way too fluffy for legislators or Supreme Court justices to grasp.
That's possible. I do think legalistically it's a long shot. I think it's a, I know And I'm not saying it's the only place that we have to stand either. I do think, however, that given that we have a degree of choice about it, it's kind of like the same choice we have between calling somebody who buys something on the net a consumer or a customer. I think...
I know you hate that term.
I know, yeah, but it's a similar thing. I mean, it's not so much I hate it again. I put this on... I forget where I even wrote it, but it's probably on my blog, but I've been writing a lot on Linux Journal lately, too, and on IT Garage. It's not a matter of policing usage. This isn't political correction. It's a matter of accuracy.
Yep.
In the case of photography, for example, right now, people who put photographs up on Flickr after capturing those photos on a memory card, on a flash card, they're not consuming anything. They're producing. They're doing nothing but production.
Mm-hmm.
There's no consuming involved. See, I mean, it's ludicrous to refer to somebody putting up pictures on Flickr as the consumer. What the hell are they?
Mm.
A producer is actually a better term, but, I mean, to me, the more accurate term is simply amateur photographers, or just users. I mean, either one of those is more accurate.
Mm.
So what I'm calling for here is recognition that it's not so much that the net is a place instead of pipes. It's that it's a place as well as pipes. And I think it's important to grow that understanding as much as we possibly can and as consciously as we possibly can. It's not for nothing. And I mean, I'm not going to be the one arguing in front of the Supreme Court on this. I think if it comes to the Supreme Court, we're really cooked. We've already gone up there a couple times and nothing's come out in our favor since the Communications Decency Act, which is incredibly stupid and was defeated either unanimously or almost unanimously by the Supreme Court. We do have a choice about this. I mean, for example, we know there's such a thing as thought and we know there's such a thing as life, and those things are not reducible to biological processes, even if they depend on biological processes. And that's where we are right now on this thing. It's like we've got the guys who understand the biological processes are busy defining what human life is about. If we look at human life as life on the net, those are the guys that are defining it. Well, it's nothing more than chemicals moving around inside a body. And, well, it's not. You know, what a living organism does is far more than that. And while it depends on biological processes, it's not reducible to biological processes. And that's all that I'm saying, is that, you know, if you don't like the place metaphor, find another one. But what's happening is not just what goes on in the pipes. And if we let the people who want to define it entirely in terms of pipes run the show, there's not going to be a show like we understand right now.
Personally, mate, I think we better all just hope like hell that Google keeps buying dark fiber.
Well, I hope so, too. And I hope that there are, you know, I hope other companies do the same thing. We'll see.
I guess that, you know, if the history of capitalism has taught us anything, it's that, you know, when there's a paradigm shift in a particular industry, and this is like the stuff that Clayton Christensen was writing about in the late 90s, that the people who dominate the previous paradigm find it almost impossible to move into the new paradigm, and it creates a huge market opportunity for new businesses to emerge and, get funding and become the new dominant players.
So here's another way to look at that. The Christensen and others have pointed out that we I'm trying to remember the terminology. His first was the innovator's dilemma, and that essentially what happens is that that an incumbent company, like, for example, the phone companies, they can innovate. They can innovate in small increments and gradually improve whatever offering they happen to have. And then a disruptive company comes along and offers, you know, Skype is disruptive. Okay, so while the telephone companies are busy gradually improving their ordinary telephone service, Skype comes along and completely disrupts it. Right? That's an example of the innovator's dilemma. The innovator is the slow-moving large company that really can't make any bold moves if it tried, because it really doesn't know how to do anything other than gradually grow and evolve in its already established way. Now, I think there's a corollary to that, which is around the individual, essentially. I think that if we look at the history of capitalism, not just going back to the beginning, which isn't that long ago, but as it projects out into the future, we're just at the beginning of the stage of free market economics in which the most free agents are individuals and not companies. Mm-hmm. In fact, even if you look at what a company is, it's very different now than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. My father and many other guys of his generation made really Faustian bargains with the large companies they worked for, because that was the only way they were going to get insurance benefits. Large companies alone had access to capital. They could invest in stocks. They could invest in, you know, they could communicate internationally. They had international scope. There were all kinds of powers that companies had that individuals did not. Now individuals have many of those same powers. The kind of talk you and I are having, we might have been able to have inside a large company 20 or 30 years ago, but not on our own without costing an awful lot of money.
This is
having it sound like crap, too. But the point is that I think that the real threat here is from individuals, and the real opportunity is for individuals in the marketplace, and especially if the marketplace is worldwide. And the real jujitsu move that's possible by individuals is around what I call the because effect rather than the with effect. In other words, I can make more money because of my blog than with my blog. That's one of the things I've often talked about. That
yep.
People say, well, how can you make money with a blog? And I'll say, well, how do you make money with your cell phone? It's an expense, but would you do without it? No. Well, it's similar with a blog. I'm not looking to make money with the blog, but I give a lot more power and reach because of the blog. And as you do with the podcast, right? I mean, you have much more power and influence in the world because of this podcast than you had without it. That's the because effect. I don't know if you're making any money with it, but it's certainly. But we're always looking to make money with. That's the problem with the with the value chain as the only way to understand business. I think there are constellations of value that occur out of relationships that are, you know, that happen in four dimensions and that the net makes possible by reducing to zero the distance between everybody. And unencumbering those relationships with any agenda of the large companies that stand in between them. And that's what we need to make clear. I think one of the best cases we can make across the board to the politicians of the world is, look how much more can be done by anybody because the net exists. Okay? It's undeniable how much more can be done. So what is the net? You know, how does this, you know, not just, you know, who supports it, but, you know, what does it consist of? Well, it consists of, you know, a bunch of very simple protocols that make it easy for anybody to connect with anybody and to do business and make culture and do whatever else they're going to do. And as soon as you start encumbering that, you lose it. It goes away. You know, it's like saying we just got to heat up the snow to 45 degrees. Well, it's not going to be snow anymore. It's going to be something else.
But do the politicians care?
I think some of them do. And I have to make clear, too, I think it's very, very early in everything here. this is one of the graces of being an old guy. And I have two paradoxical concerns here. One is that I realize because I'm a, I mean, people think I'm a smart guy. Mostly I'm just old. I mean, I've been around long enough to see a lot of shit. And I know, I mean, I've seen so many mistakes being made over and over and over again. And I've seen so many stories that were just not the real story. I mean, that's one of the points that I made in that article. It's so typical of the press to say, oh boy, it's here's the playing field. The playing field is a regulatory environment. And on one side of the field are the telcos, and on the other side of the field are the cable guys, and they're going to fight it out, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that is just so freaking wrong, and I've seen it happen so many times, but I also know that the people writing that are working for organizations that are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and are no more clueful than they ever were, because they don't know that their businesses are being threatened and wiped out, because they don't get it. Mm-hmm. You know, it inevitably, there is going to be a matrix of sharing of information that will be the new news system. Whatever the new news system is going to rise. It's going to rise out of the kind of stuff you and I are doing right now. That's the next news system, right? It's not going to be. It's going to involve the newspapers, but the newspapers and the magazines and the television stations, and all of those services are going to be, are all going to be, you know, vegetables in a soup of what individuals are doing.
But
they're not going to be the whole show. And that's, you know. So anyway, one side of it is being old. The other side of it is because I'm old, I'm motivated to see something happen before I die. I mean, I'm 58 years old right now, and it's less than 12 years until I'm 70, which is the age at which my father died. You know, there's no guarantee I'm going to last that long. I'm
talk to Ray Kurzweil, mate.
What's that?
Got to go talk to Ray Kurzweil. He'll put you on the immortality plan.
Yeah, right. I hate it when these guys talk about immortality. It's just a silly thing. But anyway, I don't know if Kurzweil is doing that, but it's silly. I think mortality is actually a blessing. I think we need to, you know, it's nature's way of keeping the field clear, you know, and giving everybody turns. I have no desire to live forever. I just want to live till my kids grown up. You know, that's my main concern. But the net is something about which I care a great deal, and I don't want to see it fucked up. And I see some fuckage coming along, right? And I, you know, so here we are.
Oh, Doc, I'm not sure if I'm coming.
I feel like I've hogged this. I haven't heard enough about what's going on in Oz.
Oh man. Well, they're passing sedition laws here.
Oh,
at the moment.
Oh God.
If you say anything that could be construed, or write anything that could be construed to be against the government, basically they can throw you in the slammer without even a trial.
Oh my God.
It's welcome to the Middle Ages, man.
Oh, jeez. Who's behind that? I mean,
Well, the federal.
Do people want that?
Yeah, the federal government are doing it, and they're justifying it the same way they're justifying everything at the moment. It's like, well, you know, you got these Wahai Islamic terrorists running around telling people that they should be, you know, bombing Australian cities. We can't have that. We're just going to throw them away. Of course, we're only going to use it for good, and we're not going to use it for evil, but.
Right, sure.
I mean, I've said plenty of stuff on my blog and on my podcast about what I, the evils that I think my government has been involved in, and preemptive invasions of certain countries. I reckon I'm probably up for, you know, being charged under sedition laws.
Right. Well, a lot of us. You heard what happened to Hodor, right?
I talked about that on my show last night after reading about it on your blog.
Right, yeah.
Googling him at the Border Patrol.
Right, the Border Patrol with, you know, reading blogs.
Well, you know,
I've only got, what, at this point, I think there are 3 million things out there with my name on them. At this point, I'm pretty easy to track. Whatever I've had to say is rather well distributed at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, I come to the U.S. a couple of times a year, and I know it's only a matter of time before I'm going to be standing at customs at LAX or JFK, and they're going to be Googling me going, oh, you're that Cameron Riley.
Yeah, yeah.
Follow us this way, man with cavity search glove is ready for you, you know.
A few years ago, my wife was coming back from Hong Kong, and she arrived in San Francisco, and this And it was right after there was a big to-do about software piracy, and Microsoft was making about a really big deal about trafficking and bad and illegal software. And this guy was going around from suitcase to suitcase with a beagle on a leash, and the guy standing next to my wife turns to her and dryly says, "Software dog." Dog sniffing for, so I can imagine a blog dog, right? Blog dog.
Well, you know, it happened to Jeremy Wright earlier in the year when he tried to get in, and he did the same thing that Hoda did. He was coming from Canada into the US, and he told them he was going to a blogging conference. So the first tip is never tell people you're a blogger. It's, you know,
I always say is I'm going to a business meeting, and they say name the company. I'll name the the organizer. IDG. IDG is holding a meeting, and I'm going to a meeting with IDG. And okay, they stamp the thing, and you walk on through. You know, or I'm visiting friends. Who are the friends? Here they are. You know, and that's it. You know, I just look like another bearded tourist, and that's fine.
Yeah, so that's the tip, people. Don't tip them off that you're a blogger or a podcaster. No, it's not cool to wear your "I'm blogging this" T-shirt.
No, US. That's bad. Actually, I'm wearing my T-shirt right now that says "Media Whore." So I wouldn't wear that, actually.
Well, Doc, it's a pleasure as always. I'm not sure if I'm leaving the conversation any more feeling uplifted than I was coming into it, but I guess it's about building awareness.
The uplift I'd give you is that I actually think that the net still has more ways to route around that kind of crap than it does, than anybody give it full credit for. But I think it's important to fight the bad guys no matter what.
Just speaking of routing around, it's off topic, but I said this on my show yesterday. I just found out a couple of days ago that when I was 12, I suffered fairly significant brain damage to my left prefrontal cortex during an accident, and I never knew about it. Until this week, I happened to have an MRI scan for eye surgery, and it showed up all of this massive brain damage where my skull was fractured when I was 12. And I was showing it to my shrink the other day, who's a neurophysiologist, and he said, well, you're fortunate because that part of the brain actually isn't fully developed when you're 12. So, you know, the neural development probably would have just routed around the damaged area and life went on.
Yeah, that's the part of the brain that experiments with drugs and cigarettes and stuff like that. And when you're 12, I remember looking at a story of a guy who had a tire iron that he was working with that flew off, and it flew into his head. It went right through his head. I mean, it went up like through his nose and out the top of his head somewhere, and. You know, he was all right. somehow it was okay. I don't know how that worked, but I hate to be in that condition. So do you remember anything of the accident?
Oh, yeah, I remember the accident, and I've always known I had the accident, and I'm going in for eye surgery, which is sort of a, 25-year later side effect of the accident. Mm. But I, never had any idea that I was brain damaged. But my analogy is that we've got to think of the internet as a 12-year-old child, right? And they can fuck around with it, but we'll figure out a way to route around.
Well, the nice thing is that the internet is nothing but people's brains, right?
So and some of them, like the telcos, are brain damaged.
Right, exactly.
And we're going to have to route around them.
That's the thing. It's the, David Eisenberg, who'd be really good to interview on this. Actually, if you want to get a couple of really, really informative people on this, the ones you want are, there are three of them. One's David Eisenberg, who's at Eisen.com or Eisen.org, I-S-E-N, Berg. Another is Susan Crawford, who was recently named an ICANN board member, which is a really hopeful sign. And I think there are links on my blog to all these guys. And the third one is Brett Fawcett. I think Susan, David, and Brett are all in my blog role. And Brett's really good. He's the guy who's doing a lot of the good legalistic thinking on this stuff. So I think both Susan and David are attorneys. Susan and Brett, David Eisenberg is a his PhD. But David's the one who wrote The Rise of the Stupid Network when he was still working at AT&T. And his case was that while the telcos are busy trying to make networks as smart as possible, what the real intelligence on the network, which is on the outside of the network, wanted was for the network to be as stupid as possible in the middle.
Just to get out of the way.
And that's actually the kind of thing, I mean, I think that particular metaphor, that what you want is a stupid network. Stupid networks are good, smart networks are bad. And smart networks know what's best for you, and stupid networks don't. And if you could characterize, for example, you know, even the Constitution, a good Constitution, but freedom is stupid. You know, freedom is not, you know, all efforts to thwart freedom are very smart, and all efforts to allow freedom are fundamentally stupid, meaning that it's good that they're stupid and they let the people be smart. You know, leave the free speech up to the people and go ahead and be, you know, have a stupid government about it. But it's really, you know, it's when the government wants to be smart and say, no, we need sedition laws in order to fight the terrorists, that you get really stupid results that make life hard for the intelligent people.
I think there's some very wise words to finish up with, Doc. Thanks very much, mate.
Does that give you hope?
No, but...
I didn't think so.
You know, it's going to keep me up at nights, and that's probably a good thing right now. We don't want people to have hope. We want them to be worried because they, you know, it's better to be paranoid about this kind of stuff and be looking over our shoulder and doing something about it than, actually, and that's something I meant to say. Until I read your article, after speaking to David and reading your article, in the 10 or 11 years that I've been full-time working in the net industry, I have never once, never, ever, seriously even given any consideration to whether or not the internet would be around tomorrow. It was just one of those things that I took for granted and assumed that there'd be more bandwidth and it would be cheaper next year than there was this year.
Yeah.
And I've never, you know, I fully expect the radio industry to try and stop podcasting. I fully expect the music industry to try and stop PodSafe music. And I fully expect all of these things to happen. But I never once questioned whether or not the internet itself would be there tomorrow. And, you know, your article really woke me up to that.
Well, try this for size. This is an interesting thing for me, and one of the things that kind of blew my mind, and that is, ask people what the net is. It's interesting, because you get all kinds of answers, and the answers are show that we haven't really, it isn't formed. It's kind of like the frontal lobe of your 12-year-old brain, right? I mean, it wasn't, it's not there yet, you know, you didn't need this part yet. But we've not really needed to know what the net was. But if you ask people, you get a lot of different answers. If you ask them, you know, what's the highway system, or what's the, what's the water utility do, you know, they'll tell you. They have no problem with that. That's a pretty simple and straightforward thing. What's the electric system? Those are known, simple, straightforward things, but the internet is not. And what these guys want to do is define the internet as a service provided by phone companies and cable companies, rather than something that's independent of those that, you know, that they happen to provide access to. But, yeah. So,
what is the Matrix? That's the question for the
day. What is the Matrix? Yeah.
Thank you, Doc.
My favorite movie of all time, by the way.
Is it really?
That's
great. Yeah. It was a great movie. The sequels, I didn't think, quite lived up to
the sequels weren't up to it, but the notion that the world can be the world we know can be a manufactured place, I think, is an incredibly good metaphor for marketing. It's just, you know, there's an awful lot of what we take for granted that is in fact the market tricks of a sort, and that's often what marketing wants you to do, and marketing wants you to be that battery that keeps it going.
Yep.
And that's in essence though they came out at the same time and had nothing to do with each other, Clue Train was about the Matrix.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
It really was.
All sorts have come along. You know, it's very true with propaganda too, that the manufacturing the consent of the people, as Chomsky and his collaborators said.
Right. Yeah, manufactured consent is the Matrix. And and you function as food for it. I mean, that's how it is. That's yep. how it works.
And we'll tell you whatever we need to tell you to keep you as happy little consumers.
Exactly.
Keep buying the stuff, keep spending money, and don't think too hard.
Right. Right.
Doc Searles, thanks very much for coming on, mate. It was a pleasure as always. You take care.
Okay. You too. Thanks,
cheers.
Cameron.
Bye.
Hey. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, from the beginning. That's right. I'm back at the end. I waited around for the entire podcast just to tell you that it was brought to you by Motorola. Yeah, dude. I gotta get some nachos. I am so hungry. Are there any near your house?
The Podcast Network. Real power can't be given.
It must be taken.